Good afternoon, everybody. I'd like to go ahead and call Senate Finance Committee to order March 18th, 3:15 PM for the afternoon session. We're going to continue to review capital budget 230 and the deferred maintenance budget 253. We've got three more departments to do. We're going to go till 3:30, and then we're going to take an at ease till 4 o'clock. So if I can have the Department of Corrections come up, please. Introduce yourself for the record, who you represent, and then maybe start with the first appropriation in the deferred maintenance, the only appropriation in deferred maintenance.
Thank you to the chair. For the record, my name is Leslie Houston. I'm the Director of Administrative Services for the Department of Corrections.
For the record, Dwayne Peoples, Department of Corrections.
For the first project for our deferred maintenance projects, we're referencing project 49376. We are requesting 11 projects to be funded, totaling $6,500,000 in general fund dollars. And the first project on our list is at the Anvil Mountain Correctional Center in Nome, and this comes under the category of fire life, safety, and security. And this is a security control system replacement.
Does any of the members have any questions on the list on page 9?
Yep.
Okay, next item.
Do we want to go down, sir, to the chair? Do we want to go down the full list of the 11 projects?
No.
No.
Okay, thank you. Then we'll go to our FY11 capital request.
Right. You have three appropriations.
Referencing project number 45637, the title is the Anchorage Correctional Complex Renovation and Remodeling, for a total of $350,000 general fund dollars. Referencing project number 41516, Community Jail Repairs, Renovations, and Equipment, for $100,000 general fund.
I want, for the record, that Senator Hoffman here, Senator Huggins, Senator Thomas, and Senator Egan, and Senator Olson just stepped out. Myself, Senator Stedman. Forgot to mention that for the record when we opened up. Go ahead.
And that was our last project, sir.
Okay. Any questions on the correction? Okay, seeing none, thank you. We'll go to the next department, Department of Law. Do you have anything in the deferred maintenance?
No.
I wonder I couldn't find you boys. So you have one item?
We have one item, yes.
Better give us a good pitch.
For the record,
make any changes, you only have one.
For the record, my name's Dave Blaze, Administrative Services Director for the Department of Law.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Rick Sabodny, the Deputy Attorney General for the Criminal Division.
We have it's project 49182. And the project is intended to put key cards in our Anchorage facilities. Right now we use keys, and when we the loss of a key can get very expensive if we determine we have to change all the locks in the building.
Any questions on the Senator Thomas?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is not the day coming, I see it in all the movies, you know, where we're using eyes or thumbs or some kind of print or something like that, which is something that hopefully isn't lost. And
That technology it's out there and available. It is expensive. We briefly explored that actually for our computer system and have not gone down that path yet.
Okay. I was just curious. Thanks.
Any other questions for the department? Okay, thank you. Last, this is the one we've been looking for since Monday. Office of the Governor, language section. That's next on my list. Not surprised.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Linda Perez, Administrative Services Director for the Office of the Governor. Did you want an overview on our two capital projects or just the language section?
Yes.
On the capital projects, we have no deferred maintenance requests, but capital projects reference number 49388 for the Division of Elections Technology Refresh. We're requesting $123,800 in general funds. That represents the scheduled replacement of desktop computer software and operating system every 4 years within the department.
You'll have to speak into the microphone.
Is this better? Amended project number 48416 is a request for elections to receive the authority to expend federal monies received in the election fund from the Help America Vote Act. It's an ongoing appropriation from the federal government to better the process of elections throughout the state.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Karen Rayfield with the Office of Management and Budget. Just very quickly to run through the capital language sections of the budget. I believe in your binders you have the pages for the language section in the capital budget. I'll just quickly highlight for you. There were four amendments in this particular section that have already been transmitted. But if I could, section 7, Mr. Chairman, is the portion of the bill that allows for state agencies to go to legislative budget and audit if there are requests that come in for federal or other program receipts. Section 8 is the fund transfer portion of the bill. There are a number of items in that particular section. A has to do with the Alaska Capital Income Fund. B is the federal Help America Vote Act funds that Ms. Perez just spoke to. And that was one of the amendments that were submitted to you on February 17th on line 24 of the bill. The sum of, and that particular dollar amount should read $1,425,000. That was one of the amendments that was submitted to you. On the next line, 25, the amendment was for $74,900 from the general fund for the matching portion. We will be submitting to you today an amendment to actually remove the general fund match requirement. The Division of Elections was notified that they had met their match requirements, so they wouldn't need any additional general fund. So you'll see that, Mr. Chairman. The next sections C, or subpart C of section 8, is the $25 million request for the Renewable Energy Fund. Subpart D is the amount of, in the original bill, $150 million for the AGEA reimbursement fund. We did submit an amendment to you on February 17th to reduce that amount to $140 million based on the latest information from the Department of Revenue.
And then maybe on that one you could bring us back a breakdown of TransCanada and who they're paying how much to. There should be some detail, I think, in one of the reports.
Mr. Chairman, yes, I think that the Department of Revenue has provided a report, provides a monthly report to you. We can certainly make sure that the committee has copies of that. On the next page of the language section is subpart E, has to do with the ADA dividend into the Power Project Fund. Section 9 is the insurance claims section. Again, that's pretty straightforward boilerplate language that comes to you every year. Section 10 is the National Petroleum Reserve Alaska Impact Grant Program. We did submit an amendment on February 17th to reduce that dollar amount from the $14.9 million roughly that was requested down to $4,847,165 for specific grants. There apparently is based on, this revenue comes from leasing, and apparently during this period, they're not anticipating that additional revenue. So the grant amount was reduced in our amended budget. The next section, Mr. Chairman, section 11, has to do with the actual costs associated with issuing the certificates of participation in the Department of Revenue. That would be, of course, contingent upon your action to approve that certificate of participation bill that's before the committee. Mr. Chairman, in one of the amendments that we had requested that's in your packet is a new section having to do with the Alaska Class Ferry. I know they discussed it with the, you discussed it with the Department of Transportation the other day. It's a request to access $60 million that was set aside in the Vessel Replacement Fund and then redirect two prior federal appropriations for fast ferries to the Alaska Class Ferry project. So that is a new section, and that should be in your binder. And then finally, the lapse section in 12 just provides for the lapse of the various capital appropriations and then the effective date. And Mr. Chairman, that's the summary of the language section.
Do you have any questions?
Mr. Chairman, what was your last statement?
Pardon me?
Your last statement you made lapsing.
Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. In section 12, there it outlines the specific lapsing appropriations for the various sections of the capital budget.
Do we have a list of those, Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hoffman, it basically describes the appropriations made in the various components of the entire capital budget that would have a particularly a lapse extension that are for capital projects. Perhaps I'm not understanding your question, Senator.
In the white pages right behind.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any questions for the OMB Director? I think that pretty much wraps it up.
Thank you.
Ms. Rigel? Okay. Just before you run off, Senator Thomas, before we have an at ease.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just one general question. Through all the budgets, there's a lot of very similar type projects, particularly the IT stuff. Is that done individually by each department?
Mr. Chairman?
Contractually with someone to come in and take a look at theirs? Is there not, if that's done that way, is there not some economy of scale of saying we have several departments that almost everybody had that kind of stuff in there, some much more than others, so it may not have been worth fooling with some of the smaller stuff where they're just changing out some computers, but some of them were wholesale changes of their entire systems.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Thomas, you may know that we have a fairly extensive IT planning process that goes on every year so that projects go through a review internally. There's a group of technical people that review them, then there's a management level group of people that review the projects to do things like make sure if there are a number of agencies asking, for example, imaging. Are we sharing the information that we have? Are they building them to state standards so that we don't duplicate effort across state agencies? There are always going to be projects that are specific to a program delivery in a particular department. And then, of course, we do have several agencies that have aging systems that will need replacement. So you see in the budgets before you the items that we felt that we could bring forward at this time. There are significant IT infrastructure project needs in our state.
But there's no one group that ultimately reviews everybody's request to see if there's some kind of, or is there?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Thomas, there is a group. It's called the Enterprise Investment Board, and that comprises myself, the Chief of Staff, the Commissioner of Administration, a representative from the technical group, and I'm forgetting someone off the top of my head, but there are five people, and we go through, after all the agencies have done the work, we go through a review process before we make budget decisions or recommendations then to the governor.
We're okay, going to have you. A recess here.
Just one quick question.
Question, yes.
The logic behind under fund transfers of using the Alaska Housing Capital Corporation for the funding source of the $150 million to the Alaska Gasline Inducement Act Reimbursement Fund and for the natural gas line project construction inducement. Why was the administration suggesting that is the revenue, you know, the revenue source versus general funds?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hoffman, we in both the operating and the capital budget chose to use the Alaska Housing Capital Corporation fund source for the ongoing efforts on the gas line, both the big line and the in-state gas project, and then the AGIA reimbursement fund. I know there's been some disagreement about the set-aside of those funds, that $300 million a few years ago, and whether or not it would be specifically for the gas line activities. We have, as you know, brought that forward as a potential source for these projects that are of great importance to Alaska to move these projects forward, and that we believe that funding source was an appropriate request to bring before you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We'll stand at ease till 4 o'clock, and I've asked we're going to bring up 305, Senate Bill 305 at 4, and I've asked the department and our consultants to be here between 10 minutes and 5 minutes too, so we can start right at 4, because we're going to be going this evening till 7. Right. We're at ease. We are going to now bring up Senate Bill 305, Oil and Gas Decoupling Bill. We have a new CS on Senate Bill 305 that we need to adopt. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move the Senate Finance Committee adopt CS for Senate Bill 305 Finance /S as a working document.
And I'll object for discussion. And I'll ask Legislative Consultant Mr. Roger Marks to come forward, please. Could walk through the CS.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Roger Marks with Logs and Associates. I'm under contract with LB&A to assist the committee in crafting this bill. The CS, we're talking about version S. We're going to present the CS and then discuss some proposed amendments afterwards. The CS itself, the last version relative to version E, it simply makes three fairly succinct changes. Number one, the title has been reduced in scope farther to tighten it down. And the title is an act relating to that part of the tax on oil and gas production that increases the rate of tax as the production tax value increases above $30, eliminating the effect of gas production in the determination of that rate and making that rate inapplicable to the production of gas and providing for an effective date. So again, that the intent of that is to narrow the scope of what this bill deals with. And the two other changes were simply to respond to the two technical problems that the administration brought up last week. We examined those issues and determined, yes, they were correct. Those were problems that need to be fixed. And we, and the CS, hopefully fixes those. The first of those technical issues is in Section 5. And in the last CS, version E, some of the proposed changes to AS 4355-020A, which dealt with the monthly installment payments. Some of those changes did not need to be there. They dealt with the treatment of negative production values in specific areas, and the way it had been crafted would actually be inconsistent, create an inconsistency between the monthly and annual calculations. So what we simply did was reverse those changes so those parts of O2OA read how they do now in the current law. The other technical change was in Section 8. In the production tax, there's a Section 4355-170 that deals with adjustments to lease expenditures. And these deal with how to treat transactions outside of normal production activities like facility sharing fees, reimbursements, and sale of assets, things like that. And what the new Section 8, again, simply does is give the department the authority to adopt regulations to allocate these adjustments to lease expenditures between oil and gas. So that is the total of the changes encompassed in this CS relative to the last one.
Could you maybe go over Section 8 again, please?
Sure. In 4355-170, there's a section that talks about adjustments to lease expenditures. And again, those are activities outside of normal production activities. You know, again, they address things like facility sharing fees that are received or reimbursements or sale of assets, things where the accounting is such that you want to be careful about double counting revenues or double counting costs. And since we are splitting out oil and gas for progressivity, it's necessary to carve out in those adjustment to lease expenditures how much of those expenditures apply to oil and how much applies to gas. In the last CS, as the administration pointed out last week, to do that, the administration needs authority to adopt regulations on how to split out these lease expenditures between oil and gas, and Section 8 simply gives them that authority to do that.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions on the CS? I'll go ahead and remove my objection to the adoption of the CS. Any objection to the adoption of the CS? Seeing none, version S is adopted as our working document. If we could have Commissioner Revenue maybe come forward and wants to talk about the fiscal note.
Yes, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Pat Galvin, Commissioner of the Department of Revenue. Was there a question or?
On the fiscal note?
Yes. On the fiscal note, we identify that with the changes in separating the oil and gas production tax, there's going to be changes necessary in our method of basically acquiring the information from the taxpayer and managing it in a way that actually allows us to evaluate the taxpayer's tax return. And we need to have funding in order to make the changes necessary to our information system in order to address that particular change. And so that's noted here in the operating expenditure aspect of the fiscal note. In the analysis section, we have identified in sort of an indeterminate section associated with the potential change in state revenue in the near term prior to a major gas sale. And that has to do with an issue that I think is attempted to be addressed through one of the amendments today, but basically we currently in the system combine oil and gas production statewide for the purposes of determining the progressive tax rate. It isn't until after you have established that progressive tax rate that you then separate the revenue depending upon the different segments, Cook Inlet, North Slope, and then the rest of the state, or separate out gas used in the state for a separate tax treatment. So the combination of the total quantity of gas that's produced mixed in with the oil results in the progressive rate that's used on all of the production for a particular taxpayer. With this bill, because it is separating gas from oil, it would have the effect for those current producers of both oil and gas of not providing for that combination, all the dilution that we've talked about in the context of a major gas sale is happening right now with our current oil and gas producers. We've tried to go back and look at what a potential annual financial impact may be in terms of the tax receipts, and it varies greatly with the price relationship between oil and gas for a particular period, as well as the individual taxpayer's situation in terms of relative volumes of production. We have referenced in the fiscal note that the range that we have found goes from generally tens of millions of dollars in a year to over $100 million in a particular year. And we kind of give the range of expected impact to be somewhere between 40 and 100 million, depending upon the various factors. But it's been both below the 40 and above the 100, and so it's really uncertain. And that's why we didn't put it in as a dollar value in the fiscal note.
And my understanding of that range is maybe 170 million on the high side, 40 million on the low side over 3 years, totaling a little under 300 million over two and a half or three years.
That's about what we found looking at 98, 99, and projecting out 2010.
Okay.
And then further, the fiscal note just notes in terms of the potential impact to state revenue, what we testified to last week with regard to it would bring in more revenue at times when prices between gas and oil are divergent. It would bring in less than the status quo when prices are relatively close to the 6-to-8-to-10-to-1 ratio at a higher price because of the lack of a gas progressivity element.
Yeah, the 8 to 9, the 6 is a relatively uncommon price multiple. Yeah, I think what we'll do is we'll have you redo the fiscal note, because we're going to look at a couple of amendments that'll change the fiscal note a little bit. Do we have any questions on the fiscal note? There's a couple. Just the language on the third paragraph down under the analysis, it talks about the middle of that paragraph. It says, oil and natural gas normalized at a time when natural gas was selling at relatively high prices. I think what we want to do is we want to go in and we don't quite know what normal is. So when we work on the next fiscal note, maybe we'll try to get more detail. And in particular, when we start using forward prices, so we can kind of substantiate where forward prices are coming from.
We can provide the range of impact at different price relationships, and then provide we can provide whatever information we can with regard to forecasts.
And I think we need to be a little cognizant of where the numbers are derived from. If they're derived from forward projections from the Department of Energy, or they're forward projections from some consulting firm, or they're just a number thrown on the wall. So we'll try to put a finer point on the numerics so we all understand, you know, where they're derived from.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
And we'll work with you on the next version of the fiscal note to try to make things clear to the committee members and the public of what we're dealing with.
Well, and Mr. Chair, the use of the term normalize is a reference primarily to the economic normalization in terms of the price relationship coming back to the energy equivalency. It's not a reference to what would be expected to be the expected market price going forward.
Right. I don't want to split hairs, but I think the normalcy under the price relationship between gas and oil is a different normalcy between the BTU equivalency. They're two different things.
They're different but related.
Right. Okay, with that, we'll go ahead and bring up amendment number one. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move the Senate Finance Committee adopt amendment number one.
I'll object for discussion. Mr. Marks, you want to walk us through amendment number one?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Roger Marks. Amendment number one, we call it just call it tax neutrality on current activity. We're calling it now. As Commissioner Galvin just explained, there are currently some producers in Alaska that produce both oil and gas. There are producers that have North Slope Oil and Cook Inlet Gas. There are producers that produce North Slope Oil and produce and sell small amounts of North Slope Gas. There's about, the best we can tell, about 8,000 BCF a day being sold to Alyeska, relatively small amount. If we separate oil and gas for calculating progressivity, as this bill proposes to do, the oil progressivity, as we explained last week, would be undiluted by the gas, and the effect we illustrated last week would cause the progressivity on oil to go up, which would increase taxes. Now, the progressivity would go up a fairly small amount, but when you apply a fairly small increase in progressivity to large volumes of oil at today's relatively high prices, it will create a noticeable increase in tax, as Commissioner Galvin just displayed in the fiscal note. As far as the magnitude of the effect, again, the fiscal note says, you know, 40 to 100 million. We obviously don't have as perfect information as the department. We did our own best guess, given what we believe prices and costs are. We came up with an estimate of $30 million at today's prices of oil and gas.
Or, if you can stop there, are you talking about the current year?
Right, at current prices, at current production, given the producers that we think are in a situation where their progressivity on oil would go up if they were decoupled. But regardless of the magnitude, it was never the intent of this bill to raise taxes on current activity. So that is the purpose of amendment number one, which is to offset any possible increases in taxes that would result from the passage of this bill. And what the bill does, in effect, is create a credit equal to the difference between the tax determined under the bill and the tax as it is determined now. And under the amendment, this credit would expire in 2015. This will be prior to a major gas sale, but you know, hopefully at a date after which major discussions on a tax regime for gas would have occurred. So that is what amendment number one does. It's a credit that offsets any possible increase in tax that would happen as a result of this bill.
And expires in 2015.
Expires in 2015.
And the concept there is?
Again, well, the if AGIA's taxes are locked down, the point is we want the bill to be effective when an AGIA project happens to prevent this collapse in oil revenue that we've been talking about, but we don't want it to cause tax increases on current activity. So date 2015 is a date prior to a major gas sale. And again, hopefully some major discussions on a tax regime for gas would have occurred by that date as well. That's why that date, 2015, is in there.
Okay. We have any other questions on the amendment? Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Park, you mentioned Cook Inlet as well as Prudhoe Bay gas production, or did I misunderstand?
Well, there are sets of producers now that have North Slope Oil and Cook Inlet gas, correct. And they have, and some producers are producing North Slope Oil, and they're also producing small amounts of gas for sale on the North Slope as well, namely those small volumes, the sales to Alyeska that I mentioned. Right. Those are the producers that would be in a situation that if this bill passed without this amendment, they would see tax increases based on their current activity.
Okay. Just wanted to make sure that I understood that correctly. All right. Thank you.
And again, we'll have the try to get more clarity on the last 3 years as an example of the impacts, because I think they range from, like I mentioned, from a high of maybe roughly 170 a year down to around 40, with a total somewhere under $300 million for the last 3 years. So it's a sizable amount of dilution going on as we speak. Is there any other questions on the amendment? Seeing no other questions on amendment number one, I'll remove my objection to amendment number one. Any further objection to amendment number one? Okay, we'll go ahead and adopt amendment number one. Senator Hoffman, amendment number two.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move the Senate Finance Committee adopt amendment number two.
Okay. I'll object for discussion. Mr. Marks, could you help us with amendment number two?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. There were some concerns expressed last week about the issue of cost allocation. As and I think it'd be probably useful to give a little background information and then sort of explain how the amendment works. Right now, Prudhoe Bay is an oil field. It produces about 275,000 barrels a day. And the way that oil gets produced, when it's produced, gas comes up with it. You can't bring oil out of the ground without the gas in it. And the gas is separated, and about 8 BCF a day at Prudhoe Bay is put back in the ground to repressurize the field for oil production. If we had a major gas sale in, say, the year 2020, Prudhoe Bay is expected to be producing about 200,000 barrels a day then. And, maybe if you had a 4.5 BCF a day gas pipeline, maybe something around 3 BCF a day of that would come from Prudhoe Bay. Well, at that point, Prudhoe Bay has gone from being an oil field to an oil and gas field. And that's not unique. Most fields produce oil and gas. So any field in the North Slope that's going to be contributing gas to a gas pipeline is going to be both an oil field and a gas field. Now, the costs to produce oil and gas are truly joint costs, because the same process that produces one produces the other. And so with this bill, it's necessary to allocate costs between oil and gas if we're going to tax them separately. It can be a complicated process, but as was pointed out last week, it's done all the time. Now, there's under the current approach in the tax law, 4355, there are some situations where oil and gas costs have to be allocated. And under the current law, the department has been given the authority under AS 4355-165H, and they've been given the authority to adopt regulations for allocating costs between oil and gas. And we believe it would probably be most appropriate within the context of this bill for them to retain that authority. As recipients of confidential cost data, they're in the best position to evaluate costs. A regulatory process allows more time than a statutory process like this. And like this process, a regulatory process is public. Now, if the members of the committee are not comfortable with giving the department that authority, This amendment provides some additional guidance to the department, which consistent with what we believe the most reasonable approach to allocate costs that we have examined is. And that is what we call the BTU equivalent barrel or BOE approach. And again, this is the exact same approach that the department adopted when they pursuant to having the authority to adopt regulations, this is the mechanism they came up with. Again, they came up with it for the same reason you would have to do it if this bill passed, the need to allocate costs between oil and gas. And just to simply review the mechanics of how that process works, that BOE approach, in AS 4355-900-3, which defines what a BOE barrel is, it says one barrel of oil is one BOE, and it says by statute that 6 million BTUs to the barrel, so you simply take your number of gas BTUs you have and divide by 6, and that gives you your gas BOEs, and that puts your oil and gas on an apples-apples basis. You can tell how much you have of one and how much you have of the other. And the rationale for the BOE approach is that, as we said, the same costs that produce oil produce gas, and since they're produced together, the costs are allocated based on the amounts produced. And so again, all the BOE method does is puts oil and gas on an apples-apples basis in terms of the relative volumes. Now, Commissioner Galvin last week laid out some other methods that are out there different than the BOE approach. Now, I don't think he was saying that any one of those was preferable, and I don't think he was representing that was an exhaustive list of methods. But just looking over those methods, I'd like to just briefly go through them and just lay out why we think, again, the BOE method is more reasonable than these methods. I mean, one of the methods that was laid out was called the item-by-item attribute method, where you look at every single cost item and decide whether it's oil or gas. Well, where, again, the costs are truly joint, we don't think that would be appropriate. There's a dominant use approach where you say it's either all oil or all gas. And again, we're in a situation where you have large volumes of oil and large volumes of gas. We don't think that's appropriate. There's the deemed approach. The costs are all deemed one, either oil or gas, unless an item is 100% the other. Again, where there's large volumes of both being produced, we don't think that's appropriate. There's a reserves approach. Given the uncertainty surrounding reserve numbers and given the ability of producer taxpayers to control reserve numbers, we don't think that's appropriate. And then you could possibly allocate costs based on gross value. And the reason we don't think that's appropriate, if you had a situation, say, where gas prices were $6 and oil prices were $80, and a bomb goes off in the Mideast, sending oil prices up to $120. Nothing has happened on the North Slope in terms of how you're, you know, producing gas. But under that scenario, all of a sudden, a whole bunch of costs would shift to oil from gas. And one, let's make sort of one note on the gross value approach, just so there's no confusion. The department recently proposed some regulations on enacting a GIA. These are 15 AAC 55220. I believe they're out for comment now. And the reason it was necessary to put out these regs was because under the current tax, you pay one big tax. There is no oil tax. There is no gas tax. It's one total tax. But under a GIA, it's only the gas taxes that get stabilized for 10 years. So is it necessary for the department by regulation to establish what exactly is the gas tax? And the department, in this regulation, they use gross value to allocate the total tax between oil and gas. Now, allocating tax is different than allocating costs. If you think about what are the major determinants of tax, it's gross value. Gross value, what's encompassed in gross value are your market values and your transportation costs. And so gross value was a very material determinant of the difference in tax value between oil and gas. So we believe what the department did for this exercise is very appropriate and very reasonable, but bear in mind that allocating tax is different than allocating costs. And again, we don't believe the gross value approach for allocating costs would be that reasonable. And one other note I'd like to bring up. There was a concern also mentioned last week that under you know, most cost allocation approaches, how would Point Thompson be treated? Well, Point Thompson, I think the estimated cost to develop Thompson will be something like $5 to $6 billion, pretty high development costs, and these will be incurred prior to a gas sale. Now, there's a lot of gas at Point Thompson, and we think if there's a gas line, a lot of gas in the gas line will come from Point Thompson. But there was a concern that would it be really appropriate for these costs to be allocated against oil? Because if Point Thompson is developed prior to a gas line, that's the only thing there would be to allocate it against. So I want to point out a couple things to address that issue. Point Thompson, besides being a world-class gas field, is also a fairly large oil or condensate field. It's estimated to be about 300 million barrels there. In addition, Point Thompson could be developed such that it produces condensate years before it produces gas. And a lot of people have sort of stated that if you started Point Thompson condensate development the same time you blew down the gas from the field into a gas line, you'd actually lose recovery. So, the way to maximize recovery at Point Thompson could very well be to produce it as a condensate field years before a gas sale. In addition, even at a higher level, when PPT and ACES was being developed, there was a lot of discussion in terms of how capital costs would be deducted. Do you want to have depreciation like you have in state and federal corporate income tax, where the costs are deducted over a number of years? That was rejected. The tax rates and the credit rates in PPT and ACES were deliberately designed so that the cost deductions and credits would be utilized immediately as a way to boost the net present value of the producers. So unless you're going to defer deducting costs for a long time, the PTU development costs will be a deductible cost against oil under any conceivable cost allocation approach. Now with that said, go back to what Amendment 2 does. And again, we believe probably leaving it up to the department to deal with cost allocation by regulation is a good way, the best way to go. But if members of the committee feel it's important to put some guidance in place, what Amendment 2 does is keep that authority for the department, but also says, and I'll just read it, when determining a reasonable method of allocating lease expenditures between the production of oil and the production of gas, the department shall consider allocating lease expenditures in proportion to the BTU equivalent barrels of oil produced and gas produced from each lease or property. So it's just retaining given the authority the department had, this just retains what they came up with when they went through that exercise recently. So that concludes my presentation on Amendment Number 2, Mr. Chairman.
Do we have any questions on Amendment Number 2? I'll go ahead and remove my objection to Amendment Number 2. Do we have any further objection to Amendment Number 2? Seeing no more or no further objections, Amendment Number 2 is adopted. Does the committee have any questions? We're not taking action on this bill. We're going to set it aside, bring it back at a later date. Do we have any further questions on the bill from the committee? Commissioner, do you have any comments you'd like to make now or? Sure.
I Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that in amendment number two, it's an attempt to provide us with...
Are you going to identify yourself?
Oh, sorry. Pat Galvin, Commissioner, Department of Revenue. I appreciate that in amendment two, it's providing us with more guidance with regard to developing the regulations on the cost allocation. However, I just want to point out two different things. It would be our desire to have the actual, if a BOE equivalency is desired by the legislature, just have that stated in the statute. By putting it as a regulatory process with a consideration of the BOE, it will create a significant amount of uncertainty and conflict in that regulatory process. And as Mr. Marks, you know, clearly identified, there's no right or wrong answer with regard to the cost allocation that will be refined or determined during a regulatory process. It'll just be a lot of noise and a lot of positions. And at the end of the day, it's a policy call between choices. The BOE basis, for the most part, among the choices, is the one that would generate the most tax revenue. And more likely than not, all of the public, as it were, comment on the regulatory process is going to be trying to drive us away from that. If it is the legislature's desire to have that stated, rather than just, obviously it will be a consideration of ours given that it is part of our current regulatory process. If that's the allocation method that you would prefer, we would strongly request that that be stated in the statute as opposed to putting it through a regulatory process that will probably not provide any greater light to the issue. And then just related to that, I'll just note that by not having the allocation method in the statute and given the significant variations in tax obligations that could result from it, going into the open season with what is in place at the time of the start of the open season, it creates an uncertainty that could be significantly clarified if it were stated in the statute.
Well, the committee is willing to work with the department, has been trying to work with the department on language to deal with the cost allocation, which quite frankly I think is going to come down to when the fiscal terms are negotiated between the industry and the administration and brought for ratification to the legislature. And the concern here is between now and when that arrangement is put forth, and that's why we have in areas of this bill, we have a date of 2015, assuming that between now and then there would be significant discussions to finalize a lot of these. Because we don't have in the legislature as detailed of information dealing with costs and in fields and so on and so forth than the administration does. So we're at a disadvantage in certain regards to dealing with a lot of these issues. And this isn't the issue, although it's one within this bill, but this isn't the reason 305 was put on the table.
Mr. Chair, I completely appreciate that issue. The information that may be available to the question that we're going to face is if you want the allocation to be based upon some analysis of current or expected costs, as Mr. Mark said, there's going to be a significant amount of those costs that are simply joint costs of production, but there's going to be other considerations that may be brought to bear in terms of whether those costs were incurred for the purposes of one or the other, whether they're intended to be utilized for one or the other over the course of the field life. And those we would be at a better position with regard to developing the regulations, and I appreciate the offer to work with you on language if we had further guidance on how those interests would be balanced between a strict BOE basis versus a cost a cost analysis basis, which would result in potentially a different place. But we'll continue to work with you and developing that. I just wanted to make sure the committee was aware that it was an issue that we wanted to further address.
Right, because it doesn't do us a lot of good to have a laundry list of all the possible options, and we're aware that there's numerous ways that this can be dealt with. That just creates a quagmire. What we're trying to do is get to a solution between now and when we have this, these physical terms on the table to adopt, whatever they are and whenever they are, if it's 2014 or 13, who knows. But this is not, we're not after a 20 or 25-year solution here.
To the
so we'll work with you,
okay,
in your department on that, and then also on the fiscal note, and maybe you could have the have your department send us the information on the last 3 years of the impact of the cross-subsidy or dilution, however you want to call it, dealing with Cook Inlet and the North Slope, so the members could get a better idea in each given year, the swing and the dollar amounts involved.
And Mr. Chair, we'll work with you on how you want to present that, because frankly, with Amendment 1, the fiscal note, that becomes a moot point as far as the fiscal impact.
Right.
And so exactly how you want that information conveyed, we'll work with you on the method to do that.
Right, and the point dealing with the fiscal note, again, is there's information that the public needs to know in this process too, and I think it's the public needs to have the opportunity to see the fiscal impacts of what we're dealing with and the dilution offsets that have been taking place, because they're in the tens of millions. In fact, 1 year is approaching 200 million. I think it's at about 170. Mr. Marks, do you have any comments on you'd like to make before we set this bill aside?
I have no further comments, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. We'll go ahead and set this bill aside and continue to work with the administration and bring it up in a later date. We're at ease.